All right, here we are. Episode 9, very exciting. Great to see you again, Rob.
Great to see you too, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. So what is hot on your plate?
Dude, what isn't hot on my plate? What's cold on my plate? No, never, nothing ever. I don't know. I've had a lot of really good things. A lot of, tactical experiences in the trenches that always make me want to create an angsty LinkedIn post. So I just haven't had the cycles to create them. Almost created a couple today. So we're in a unique situation, of course, where, you know, we ended up with a other transactional contract with the DoD. And we are in a unique situation where we're building products that actually like major industrial heavy hitters use, like all the different launch service providers, all the big names. And our first product that we created was pretty safe and low risk. And it was kind of in-house. And it was like the, you know, different operators in the range would use it to do different things. But the second product was super ambitious. It was like, it's kind of tied to like an Elon Musk tweet, actually, where he was like, I can like create rockets faster than I can get like access to the range or something. So that entire process is called the Universal Documentation System. That's what governs it. And you kind of like, whether you're a rocket, a payload, you want to run some type of test or simulation, there's all these things where you kind of like start onboarding to the range, which is kind of becoming a platform in itself. And so we were like, we need to digitize this thing so we can instrument it and make it easier and kind of just simplify the way you manage access to things via like really cool RBAC and ABAC and stuff and all the fun buzzwords. And so we were kind of given this product to create. We kind of pitched it. We first, it was so funny. It was so organic. I was like, let's just like schedule like a discovery session slash design sync with like the SMEs for this part of the launch range. We've absolutely crushed it. And I totally unleashed like my goofy self-aware playbook where I'm like not trying to be someone I'm not and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the authenticity of the engagement is really, I think, what set it apart from some of the other kind of crazier, goofier modernization things. And we just, you know, we legit got a product into operational testing. For those of you familiar with the DoD, that's really impressive. Like a lot of people are like, oh, we created a product, an MVP in 3 months, and we're like, awesome. It's like, yeah, but is it OT'd? Because no one can adopt it unless it goes through these bureaucratic gates. Well, we hacked those bureaucratic gates and started testing like week 3 of the product. So we were already on a pathway to get adopted by operators. It was like mission ready. And so we got user adoption for the first one. The second one, that's why we got this like big opportunity to create this thing. Anyway, had a really cool kickoff. And then, so we had like a month to build like a proof of concept, but really it's like a lightweight MVP. Like pretend mm-hmm. there's like 6 epics that represent MVP. We've probably hit 4 of them in 1 month, which is pretty insane. But the final 2 are like big nasty juggernauts to deal with.
What would be examples of a couple of the scenarios in an MVP for this?
Like managing the different entities would be one. It's kind of like we're breaking it down by microservices kind of, so you can imagine, one would be like entity management. Like, are you a launch service provider? Are you another type of thing on the range? And so, yeah, like we crushed it. We like went really fast, reused a bunch of code we had from another, program that was already like accredited and like hardened and stuff. It was just brilliant. And we're just absolutely like trying to maximize the public's investment in this thing so hard. So we had just demoed our proof of concept to all of these heavy hitting companies. And part of our demo was like the most hilarious thing in the world. I was like, our secret sauce is like our self-awareness and our like realization that we're never going to be as capable as all of you. And I was like, we're the government, we're a company that's supporting the government. I was like, you know, we can't move as fast as you all. Like, you know, it was just very honest and it was very funny. This actually impacts how we prioritize features because we realize we won't be able to deliver the things you need on time. And they were just like laughing the whole time. And it was like really funny and like transparent. And they were really happy with the progress we made and how much like knowledge we had about the business domain that we were building for, because it's very like particular and nuanced and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like they walked away and we actually had we've had a couple of conversations, but today we just had a convo with the SMEs, the people on the range that are kind of like the brokers between us building the tech and, the companies that are going to benefit from it. And they were like, dude, they're stoked. Like they want to like onboard you, like formalize relationships, like really cool. So it landed well, and I think our government stakeholders were super excited. And we went downstairs, and this like FFRDC guy, which is like a federally funded research center or whatever, it's kind of like MITRE. It's a company called Aerospace that's also in the mix. He was like, "Hey guys, by the way, I randomly brought in ice cream to celebrate." It was the most obscure thing. I had brought like donuts and did like the coffee thing for like the room and stuff. And so we just ate like a bunch of random ice cream. I don't even know where he got it from. I feel like he got it from a vending machine because we had like ice cream sandwiches and like the weird like carnival like ice cream cones with like those little nut sprinkles on it and stuff. And it was ridiculous, dude. And we just crushed the ice cream. Everyone was super jazzed. And then I drove back to my powerless home after Helene because I didn't think we were going to get hit. That's why I drove down there. I was like, "Oh, we're fine here." And so I was down here, and my wife is like, "We lost power. There were tornadoes everywhere."
How
Crazy.
long did it take to get power back?
A week.
Holy
Yeah, it was
Did you get to
weird.
break out the toys, like little generators and power banks and solar panels, or what do you got
Unfortunately
down
not,
there?
dude. Even worse. Even worse. We had some toys. We had some really cool power banky things, but we didn't have a generator. I was actually grossed out by like what any type of inconvenience does to people that are so used to these things, like just like seeing the creepy gas station vibes and like just how fast the behaviors change. I had a friend here that's like really into gaming and stuff, and he moved down from the Northeast, and he's like, really successful, like kind of just, single dude, and just he's used to just gaming and just having a bunch of things, and he's like, "I can't deal with this." He's like driving around the town and stuff, like in his car. And it was because it was warm that week, coastal Georgia. And I kind of was like, if we can't survive this, we can't survive anything type vibe. And I was like, what do we do? Crack windows? Like, let's just tough through it and like enjoy each other. Like, me and the family all posted up. We have like a pretty kind of larger like kitchen living room space for this like old 70s ranch house I have. And we just posted up. We threw like solar lights all over it, so it looked like kind of like this like crazy holiday vibe. And we had these, what are they called? They're like these little like foam cubes that are so popular. Do you know what I'm talking
Foam
about? It's a
cubes.
specific product. Yeah, it's like these things you can like build forts with.
Oh, like
Anyway,
the nuggets?
nuggets. Yes, dude.
Yeah, they're from Durham. Yeah, they're from here.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah, we have a nuggets, dude. Like unreasonable amount of nuggets in our house. And so we just kind of laid them out, created this like camp setting. And like me and the fam were just laughing. We had the animals everywhere, a bunch of cats and stuff. And we were like recording like TikTok videos, joking and stuff, and being like really sarcastic. It was just so funny. We got, because we still had telecom, of course, but it was great. We really got to connect. We had less tech than usual, and just got to have some hilarious conversations and just riff it. It was so funny. So yeah, that was one of the things hot on my plate. How about you? Anything crazy?
I rigged up this week. It's actually supposed to be like an automated indoor cat feeder of sorts, but
Okay.
it's got a camera, including night vision and a two-way microphone. And so I rigged it outside with the chickens, and so I can if I'm not home, if I can listen in and hear if they're making noise, I can press the button and it will. Well, one, I can go, "Hey, chicken, shut up," or I can press the button, it'll shoot feed out, which will then get them to come eat. And
Like
then you
a
can do,
feed grenade.
so it's, we'll see how long it lasts. It was like $60, and I don't know, it's not really made for the outdoors, but it seems nifty and
That's
fun.
so cool. I love that.
And then just other things I've been thinking about. I was obsessing recently around just a particular problem and challenge and dealing with various people, and kind of got in that loop. One of good things someone told me once is, why are you letting these people that you don't even respect like live rent free in your head?
Yeah.
Like they're, why are you letting them influence you? And oh yeah, and so, I was like, how do I get out of this loop? Even though, even though you recognize something, it still doesn't make it go away necessarily. It's still hard. And so I was, kind of focusing on, yes, how do I get them out of my head? I'm like, 'cause this is a problem, and this is, how do I deal with this thing that they've caused? And then that led me to thinking, like, wait, like, is this even the right problem to solve? Like, does this problem need solving at all? And is the solution to getting this person out of my head, finding a solution to this particular problem, which then led me to, hearkening back to the Matrix scene of the little kid with the spoon saying, like, you can't bend the spoon, that's impossible. It was like, you can't solve that problem, that's impossible. What you need to realize is there is no spoon. There is no problem. Just let it go. And that was the thing that broke me out of it. It was like, oh, wait. Yes, it might be impossible to solve that problem I'm obsessing about. And then I realized it's not really a problem.
That's true. Why do you think people end up in those situations? I feel like it's so common, right? You can have a conversation with anyone who's operating, at the enterprise level, like some type of function where you're like forced to collaborate with people. Everyone has a story about like a toxic leader, an unreasonable employee, like just quirks. Like, how do you like, I guess it's not how do you deal with it, but it's like, why is it everywhere? And what's the remedy other than just like quitting and joining a startup with like a high trust group of people? You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that's one of the perks of startups, not to rabbit hole. It's like more than just like the chaos and the fun factor of it. It's like the fact that you get to build with like four other people or two other people or whatever. And it's like you just have a small team. You're able to like negotiate things that you disagree on really easily. You get to like build empathy with each other because you kind of need each other to survive. Like there's just elements of the startup that make it more like, and you feel it when you talk to people. It's not just the corny like startup bro vibe. It's like people just feel more fluid when they're working at a startup and they're collecting a check from a startup. They're just kind of more confident in what value they're producing, what they're responsible for, the hats that they wear. It's so much more than just like a, oh, it's a new thing and it's funded and it's just like, this honeymoon phase thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, a somewhat flippant answer is like such things don't grow on trees. I mean, like, I'm sure there are a large number of people who hear you say that and they're like, yeah, I'll go do that. You might need to calculate, okay, what's the risk long term, what's the money short term, and all that. But once you get past that, then what? Where are you know how there's a very clear route into the normal situation. It's very clear how to join those groups.
It
It's
is.
less clear on the four trustworthy person startup and where those exist. And maybe that's an opportunity. Maybe that there's the startup
Yeah.
there is how to help people find and or probably the more common, I would guess, is there's four separate people in a similar situation. The less ideal scenario going, you know what? I'd be willing to get together with three other trustworthy people, with a core idea and go after it. But how do those people connect? So I think there's a gap there. I don't know. Have you thought through that or seen things like that?
Oh, dude, we can rabbit hole for hours. There's concepts that like touch this topic that aren't exactly this, but like one example is like I've been working on, not to topic change, I promise that we're gonna get back to core question that's related to like how do you assemble a four person team that's high trust and isolated from like the poison of a larger enterprise. And like I've been like really rethinking the way that we work. Because in addition, these enterprises are like pretty low ROI from like a time injection versus like valuable output ratio, right? Like there's a bunch of people just like kind of wandering around doing a bunch of things that are like theoretically relevant or valuable or whatever. No one really can measure it. Nobody wants to measure it because that's kind of cringy. Like it's weird, right? And the government's the craziest situation, right? The government has everyone jokes around and gives me crap for my situation and working with the government. And I just have like a different ethos and mentality. But really, like a lot of the situations are massive jobs programs where people are getting paid like literally 10 to 1,000,000% more than they would get paid in the private sector. Like there's a situation I experienced recently where there's a marketing team working for the government, and they're kind of a bunch of people doing things and getting paid all this money, and like the output's very questionable. I haven't like really seen anything. It's been multiple months that they've been involved. And on top of all of it, like the types of things they're doing are like 25K in the private sector all day, like onshore, like not offshore, like 25K brand identity package, website, the whole nine, boom, 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 like really high tier. You're partnering with a company that has like, 100,000 followers on LinkedIn. You pay 25K and you get like a gorgeous end result. Like the government, I think, and the DoD specifically is the only organization that could somehow find a way to pay like 200 million% on that private sector experience for a partnership with someone who has 100 followers on LinkedIn, a broken website, like just a fake entity. And it's like only the DoD could end up in this situation, right? And so like, so I've been thinking about your problem, not your problem, but a problem you mentioned where there's challenges in the enterprise and people want to have this high trust small team. And I've been thinking about the jobs program vibes of the government, which regardless of what your opinions are, it's just uninspiring when it comes to working. We spend 8 to 12 hours a day doing this stuff. Like hopefully it's kind of relevant or impacting something we care about. And so I think there's a new way of working, and I'm actually running a experiment right now, like pretty inexpensive, but also like enticing because there's money involved, where I've created a micro contract off of a deal I got, and I used LLMs to facilitate it. So I created the contract with a large language model, and I had the large language model interpret that executed contract and create mini puzzle pieces for the different 1099 roles that I'm going to break out. And they're all highly accurate and monitorable and like, I can hold people accountable to those deliverables. It's very accurate. Like I could take those deliverables from those micro contracts and put them in a Asana board and like literally govern the project that way. And I don't, and it's totally hands off. Like I throw them in the Asana board, we have check-ins. Are you doing it? Are you not? It's that simple. And it's sick. And like they're happy because they're getting paid and there's incentives where if they deliver certain things faster, I negotiated like flex money that it's either profit for me or extra kudos for them. I'm rolling it like towards them because I'd rather just have repeat business. But like it's cool. It's there's a new way to work, I think. There's got to be a new way. And right when blockchain's emerging and AI is emerging, there's like some cool transactional things where you can execute contracts in like an automated, trustworthy way, and get people money for doing real stuff.
You may have hit upon it. On that note, related to LLMs, as I've spent more time lately, inspired by you, digging, I got my subscription to ChatGPT now, digging in there. Why is it, would you say, why, for reasons we don't need to go into, I had asked it for an image of a little man riding a sandworm from Dune. So what I get back is, a plausible rendition of this, but the worm, the head was basically like a dragon. So it had these big teeth and eyes. And so, as one might expect, I said, "That's fantastic. Thank you, future robot overlord. Would you consider removing the teeth and the eyes from the worm?" And it said, "No problem. I can do that. Absolutely." And it generates a new picture, and I'm all excited as it's generating and it pops out. And what it has done is it has closed the mouth of the dragon and made the eyes bigger. And said, "Here you go. I have removed the teeth and eyes. How else may I serve you?" Oh, how does that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I'm sure there's for like brilliant AI engineers, I'm sure there's a way to like map the context to the way that it inferred certain things, but I mean that exact example exists in every little detail, right? Even when it comes to more of the textual NLP stuff, like and that's why I think like there's this beautiful kind of combination and dance, this triad of ways to increase the accuracy for generative slash creative AI. And that's, obviously prompt engineering, like building like relevant prompt, trying to bake as much logic into that as you can, because honestly, it's the cheapest way to influence accuracy, cost or other than your time. Then there's tuning, of course, which is like really expensive. And it also kind of makes you compete with the releases of the model because you have to retune the next one that comes out. Or maybe the tuning you did wasn't relevant because they just learned better and smarter ways to do things. Of course, there's RAG, which is like the augmented kind of integration of vectorized data. And RAG is the most interesting one. And that integration between the RAG service that you have and your LLM, I think, is where kind of this type of magic happens, where if you want to, because the beauty is like spinning out here, dude. I look at AI in like three categories, or kind of automation in three categories. It's like dirty algorithms like Monte Carlo, Gaussian algorithms. Second category is like predictive analytics, right? NLP model training, all the stuff we've experienced up until OpenAI changed the world. And then there's generative AI, where it's like, and as you get closer to generative AI, it's like more flexibility, like, less accuracy required, kind of more contextual, and it's cool. Like, it's just interesting, right? They could like produce this output. And so RAG and the services that integrate the RAG capability with the LLM, we're going to see so much innovation in that one space, like making sure you can have a proprietary, unique data set that is just ridiculously context rich. And that's where all the logic is placed, because like you're never going to compete with like Mistral, Gemini, freaking, OpenAI, Claude. Like, they're just multi-billions of dollars to create these things. And they've made so much progress for the, you're dead in the water kind of.
But
So
why
yeah.
can they not take the eyes off the worm?
I don't know, maybe it's biased. Did you try like, it's cool. It would be cool to start another conversation and try to start a new journey prompting. It's almost like a scratch pad where you have to rip it out of the notebook and just scratch instead of trying to like erase that spot that now has this like, kind of like low opacity kind of freaking erased pencil mark there.
Yeah, I'll try it. Like it felt like I had just learned that the red stove means hot.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't want to touch it again. Like the I was like, if I have failed at removing a thing from another thing by simply, I it's not something you can be that you can simplify further. That was perfect. Give me the same thing without X.
Oh, it's yeah, really frustrating. I see what you're saying. Yeah, and I wonder if like then like there's something we didn't touch on and I don't know enough about, because I honestly just done professional things that have really commanded like this deep level of Gen AI or deep level of automation. Plus, I haven't been in the visual space. Like, a lot of my design work is like human factors, collecting customer needs feedback, enriching that. But I could see a workflow where it's like you start with like some bread and butter enterprise AI, like OpenAI. You prompt it, you get your cool worm, it has the goofy face things, the attributes, and then you take it over to whatever Adobe's AI is, I forget what it's called, and then you focus in on the pixel kind of difference, right? Especially if it's just some tweaks on the face, and then you kind of like you zoom in via Adobe to the face and start really doing some generative processes to manipulate that those pixels, and then you kind of get the result you want, but it's combining the output of different generative AI to achieve faster deliverables.
Yeah, or even at the end of the day, it's like I think to simplify even what you just said is AI gets you 80% of the way there. The
Yeah.
other 20% is going to take you. Whether you're using other AIs to do that or you moving the pixels, and I think that's a good point of like I think
That's a slogan. You should start like a hustle, like prompt engineering consultancy that like uses that slogan, and like you're the 20%.
Right,
You
exactly.
teach them how to like take the output from Gen AI and like adjust it, or you help them on the front end and the back end, and the middle is like this really cool gonculation that's occurring that like we kind of can influence.
Yeah, that seems to be the of what a lot of what I've been reading lately is the theme of like never forget that you own this. You have this tool and this assistant effectively, but like never ever ever delegate, the end result. You delegate tasks along the way. It
Yeah.
can make you a rough draft. It can summarize thing. It can here's an example of something. Give me 10 more variations on X, like that it can do, but choose the best of 10. Yeah, that's you.
I wonder, obviously it's pretty easy to guess that people are using AI. I won't say that, like, because like especially if you know someone, like the better you know somebody, the easier it is to be like, oh, you just sent me like AI stuff. And I
If
wonder if,
you have the phrase, let us delve into the world of.
yeah,
That there's a
you're an AI
tell.
bot.
If it
That's so.
summarizes exactly the thing it said in the first paragraph in an email, yeah.
Dude, two things really quick that you just reminded me of something. But like, I wonder like if people are offended by that, if you're just like sending someone like a bunch of, I call it like people's word butlers, like you had some random like word butler puke out a bunch of stuff that you didn't even read, send it to me. It's like so offensive. And then second, I tried to actually get it to be wrong. I was like, can you rewrite this LinkedIn post and use like poor grammar, like not wrong grammar, but just like grammar, like not perfectly executed. And of course, like AI is the cringiest thing in the world, where it just tries so hard, so it's just such an extreme of whatever you requested. And AI can't be imperfect, like, and imperfection is the connective tissue between us, because we're all weirdos, all like whack jobs that like relate to each other's like quirks. Like no one wants to talk to like some hollow bot. Like, dude, imagine, you know, like I didn't like as cool as automation is, and as cool as it would be to have like some synthetic relationship, it's like the opposite of like why we exist and why we're weirdos and why we join like knitting communities or like this club or that club or kind of investigate these like Reddit forums, you know?
Yeah, the best thing I've heard on that is, do you know, have you heard of Douglas Rushkoff? Familiar
No.
with him? He's a writer and other things. He uses it if he's writing a book, you know, either fiction or nonfiction. You know, he'll feed it what he's got so far, and he'll say, "Hey, write me a draft." So usually he'll use it, "Write me a draft, throw me some ideas for the next chapter or something," just as a something to
Brilliant.
kind of prompt him at. But that's not the brilliant part. The brilliant part is he'll have written a chapter and he'll go already. And he's written it, but he won't share that with the AI tool. He'll feed it the previous chapter and the book up until then and say,
Yeah.
"Hey, write me the next chapter to this book." And then he will compare what the AI turns out and what he already wrote. And anything that matches, he throws it out of his because it means it was predictable. It was the predictable direction to take the story. And so if
That's
the
brilliant.
AI went there, then, to your point, it didn't contain the magic.
It didn't contain the beautiful
Yeah.
imperfection. What's dude, that's amazing. That's a great example and use case. What's like something that let's like pretend in Mark entrepreneurship world, you created a really basic lean a like company where you are going to be people's 10xer and multiplier for like business operations, like you know, writing contracts, whatever, just doing HR stuff, whatever it ends up being, you could choose a area of the enterprise, like, and your whole goal is you are going to take like a handful of AI tools and essentially do the equivalent of a 50-person bureaucratic legacy team, but it was going to be you, and you were also going to charge for just you, and like you were cutting a bunch of people out, you had like really good deal flow, really good money, you controlled your hours. What type of service would you offer as like this kind of arbiter slash wizard of Oz of like a bunch of Gen AI capabilities where you could produce a repeatable output for a customer.
It's a great question. I think it's more of the type of issue, like maybe more of a, okay, here's all the issues to your point when we were talking about the bigger companies that have all these people that aren't necessarily getting along or different agendas or not working smoothly together, and sort of helping to gather that information, like interviewing all these people. What do you think of this? How do you think the company is pursuing this? What do you think this team is going in the right way? And I think where sort of the scale and the AI can help is how do you both aggregate and anonymize without making it not useful, so that you can create this engine where people can feed data into it, as in they can give their true opinions, their thoughts, their how they see things and what they think they want. Which, again, maybe from a jerk's perspective, or someone who's trying to do it, and then bring those together into a cohesive kind of actual story of the company and kind of develop, here are, a list of key things that will need to change or recommendations. Because, like, I've done that on a small scale with a small startup. Actually, with just me a while back, where I'd been brought in ostensibly to sort of, account manage and lead a delivery team for a specific technical problem, but, took the opportunity, under the banner of let's make sure we're building the right technical thing, to actually talk to all the different departments. And it kind of led into conversations just about the company and what's going on. And people, just when you're talking to them, if you seem, friendly and interested and trustworthy, which I am, but it came across, they just started sharing their thoughts about the company. Like, "Oh, this marketing campaign makes no sense," or, "Oh, we're selling this thing that we don't really have," or what we really need to do. And it quickly became apparent that none of them were actually talking to each other or knew that, either because of some relationship or because, again, maybe someone was a jerk, but they had a fantastic idea, but they were so bad at, communicating it that no one wanted to listen to them. And then I ended up actually collating it myself and putting it together and kind of laying it out to the CEO and actually it was the CEO and the COO of that company. Awkwardly, one of the recommendations was you need to fire your CTO immediately. And however, they were like, That's exactly what we were thinking of doing. So,
Yeah.
it was somewhat validating, but that wouldn't scale because there's two dangers there. Like one, the way to scale that, like if it's one person in a small group, I think that works. And I think that was demonstrated. But I think on the flip side, for bigger companies, what you end up having is these large consulting groups, that cost, you are paying for the, however many people to do all these interviews and generate all these reports and charts and all. And I think that's what potentially what you were throwing out there gives that middle ground where it would allow, me, for example, to provide that service to a larger company, a group of people at a reasonable cost, because you wouldn't need as many people. And because I think by definition, when you have that many people, it's much harder to distill that into a core thing. Like, but because I was the sole interviewer, the patterns were able to just brew in my head, so, to then, write out and present. Whereas I think that's where it can break down. If it's all basically material gathered by other people, and now you have to sort of figure out how it goes together, I can see that being extremely hard, extremely expensive, and probably less accurate. Whereas if, one person kind of augments their head with these AI tools, to kind of help summarize and bring things together, that's something that could potentially work.
That's
Now, on the
true.
flip side, that also seems kind of terribly isolating on its own. I don't want to be the one person with a bunch of AI bots, back to the now where I think the sweet spot is probably to your point of like four people, with different focuses and working together with the AI tools at their disposal. I think one person and a bunch of AI tools is probably not sustainable or a great idea, either. Certainly not, didn't sound very fun.
Yeah, it's totally true. I think the value you can surface, like I just recently, I've been doing a ton of like UX slash CX stuff for I'd say the last like 2.5 years. In a recent role, I created like a 15-minute interview, which is just like so bread and butter. You can execute and get people on the minute they're supposed to join, and like you promise them you're not going to take more of their time, and then. And within that 15 minutes, I introduced some like bubbly, friendly kind of like, thank you so much for taking this call. It's super authentic. It's like, just really being great, gracious that they're on, and like talking about what you're going to do with their data and like how you're trying to impact the world with it, right? And you speak to the anonymous aspect of it. But I was so shocked that in a 15-minute structured interview, you can get the equivalent of like 50 survey responses, and the fidelity of the answers is just so much higher. And it's simply because like, A, people are accountable with their time. They've dedicated time to this. And B, they're talking to a human. It's not like they're looking at a weird form. Even if the web form is super creative and the prompt is very ironic and funny and like cool, like it's so different than just hopping on with like a random dude in a hoodie sitting across from you and just being like, hey, like, what are some of your challenges with this product? Like, is it working? Is it solving the problems you needed to solve? And it's like just endearing and real. And people love it.
Yeah.
And I
And because they
wonder.
can't trust the form, where's it going to get? One, I think just historically, the odds of them get, their experience with getting good results from filling out a form is low. And also, you don't know where that data is going, whereas like you've established trust with them. They're willing to share. And back to again, it helps you being a person helps you gather that data and get honest feedback. And then when you put it together and deliver it to whoever you're delivering it to, they can't poke, they can, and which is kind of the breakdown of if multiple people try to explain, give feedback to someone, they can be like, no, I'm going to poke holes in and my perception of you. Whereas if you have basically collated a message from across a bunch of people, and now you are delivering that to the person, they kind of can't push back or say, oh, well, that's just that person. You're like, no, like these are the distilled patterns that we're hearing across the board. People's
Yep.
motivations and the reasons for whatever might be different and maybe not valid, but at the end of the day, if eight people are perceiving something, there's something there, but you've been able to intermediate, disintermediate that or intermediate that. Now, I guess you've intermediated, you've inserted yourself in the middle as a good thing so that it's the thing itself that must be dealt with, and acknowledged. And you've basically protected the people behind it who, for better or worse, can weaken the message for whatever quirks they have.
Yeah, totally. And there's different things on the spectrum of like fluid from an insight perspective. Like if you get some type of insight that like an industrial door in a manufacturing facility is closing on people's arms, it's pretty straightforward. You're gonna like fix that. But if you get an insight of somebody's opinion or a feeling that they have, even if you can quantify it and there's more than one and it's interesting, it's still fluid, right? You don't have to completely pivot the entire ship. You can like experiment and slowly guide adjustments and tweaks and see how those kind of change the people's responses and behaviors. I think it's cool. Like that's how I also view like risk management. It's all like very fluid. The government, like the DoD especially, always tries to be like, very, very black and white about, or just one and zero about like kind of their approach to security and stuff. And it's like, come on, like in an emergency situation, you're gonna throw security out the window and you're just gonna like use whatever you need to use to get the job done. And so like if you know you're gonna do that, how risky is it to play these weird games when we don't have a big issue? And what's the kind of opportunity cost of delay, decay costs, all that stuff. So yeah, I think it's so interesting. Dude, quick question for you. And I know on for a while, but if you did run like this 15-minute burst interview session and you're harvesting data on behalf of an enterprise, if you, what hour would you choose to conduct these interviews if you were only given 1 hour to schedule 4 interviews a day, and why?
I'm going to actually say it's probably controversial. I would do it over lunch.
Dude, that's exactly what I was thinking. That's really funny. Like, yeah, that's just because I was like, should I do it in the morning, the evening? And then I was like, I wonder if you can convince someone at lunchtime.
Because people have things to do. So if you can just get them out of like, hey, I'm going to actually improve an hour of your day and you can be more comfortable. You can just talk. We're just having lunch. You're just sharing your thoughts. That's how I would do it.
That's cool. That's great feedback. That's going in the red book.
There we go. The red book. Yes.
I have a vintage label machine.
Nice. Oh, I love those. The
Yeah,
dino, something like
I forget
that.
that now.
Awesome.
Super excited.
And so, to start to bring this to a close, I think wrapping back around, I think it comes back to, again, not just what is the problem you're trying to solve. That's obviously a critical important that people get on the same page about. But even more importantly, and certainly a follow-up from that, is that the right problem to solve? Like you might actually get agreement across the company on what problem you're trying to solve, but if it's not the right problem, then you're gonna fail. And so I've seen this repeatedly of just again people knocking something out of the park, and it wasn't what mattered. Like it wasn't in that 20% that mattered. It was just 80% of stuff you needed to do, and it wasn't that need to be done, but if you did those back to the worm to really bring it back together, the worm with the teeth and eyes, if that's what you ended up with, it's a fail. But that was 80% there. The real problem you need to solve is, again, how do we get a worm that looks like the worm from Dune, which has no eyes or teeth? And so it all comes together. A great example of, again, how you can get so close and completely fail. And so I think that's the core message, I guess, of this episode is like, are you solving the problems that the world needs you to solve? And or your job or you personally, whatever, are you focusing on the right thing?
Yeah, it's the world, man. We're all connected. That's a great ending line, dude. That's really awesome. It's definitely making me reflect on things. Mark, thanks for having me. It's great as always.
All right. Thanks, Rob. I'll see you soon. Bye.